Nice to have you before the board.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve a portion of your...
Yes, sir. 3 minutes.
You have the 3 minutes, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Al Shea, a lawyer with Morgan Lewis here representing Alice C. Tyler Village of Child Health for Child Health, the residential treatment center here in the Commonwealth. And what we're talking about today is the agency, DMAS's determination to retract over $1 million from the provider based on an audit that took place for a time period of January of 2008 through March 31 of 2009. And during that time period, there were essentially two error codes identified for purposes of the retraction. Error code 9004, which existed for the entire time period of the audit, and then error code 9008, which was only cited for essentially the first half of the audit period.
If I can maybe help, because you have a whole lot to cover here.
Sure.
So if I could help you to identify the issues as I see them, it seems that what's going on here is your client has provided assistance, help to people who are in need of services.
Yes, sir.
And it seems also that the Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services has certain protocols, I'm using that term broadly, that must be met before these services can be paid for. And part of these protocols require that certain documentation be provided for whatever services, whatever you want to term them, are provided. And if that documentation, according to the department, if that documentation is not provided, then they're going to refuse to pay or ask for reimbursement for things that they have paid for.
Correct.
And the argument, as I understand it, from the Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services is that there was a lot of ambiguity or vagueness or the types of services that are not coverable as far as charges were concerned, and that there was an audit conducted and they were able to justify their determinations that the proper documentation and protocols were not met. How would you suggest from a legal standpoint, not from a factual standpoint, but from strictly a legal standpoint, how you have met, your client has met those protocols requirements?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So the...
I'm having a good day. Past day.
So DMAS can retract here if that documentation was not adequate. And we can't suspend reality here, too. We have to appreciate that an audit took place prior to the audit that's subject to this case, in which the same auditors audited the same documentation, although for a prior period of time, and cited a number of error codes, but cited particularly 9008 on the progress note issue for plan of next for the next session, and initially said, you owe us $802,000. As the provider was allowed to do, submitted additional documentation to say, no, we covered the plan for the next session in this other documentation. That was reviewed by the auditor. And in April of 2009, just months after the end of this audit period, the provider receives a letter saying, we've looked at your documentation, there are no billable errors, and there's no retraction at all. So it's the auditor communicated to the provider after it reviewed the documentation for that prior audit that its documentation was adequate. And so here we have the courts look at the provider agreement between the provider and the Commonwealth under contract rules. And some of these are cases of Ablix and Morrison and Culpepper talk about we're going to apply contract principles, but there are times when parties could waive or do away with, for example, material compliance, substantial performance. But one contract default principle that they didn't waive away was the course of dealings. So how is it that the provider looks at the course of dealings and how it documented the provision of services in this prior audit, gets correspondence from the agent, the expert that the DMAS puts out there to review this, says, we've looked at your documentation, in particular 9008, and you're fine. Your documentation was adequate.
Sounds like you're starting to argue detrimental reliance.
Well, it's not so much detrimental reliance. It's that, again, in the context of contract principles and how you're trying to interpret the meaning and the interpretation of the parties and how they view the contract, you know, this course of performance has to be meaningful in terms of the provider sitting there saying...
Basically, you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want the words in your mouth, is that if you get information from the department and the auditors suggesting that if you provide the documentation in this particular way and that is deemed satisfactory, and the next time that you're putting this information down, you put it in precisely the same fashion that has previously been determined to be satisfactory, you should be okay and not have sort of a change of course in what is required for the next time.
There should be consistency in the way the agency approaches these things, exactly. Well, and yes.
To follow up on Judge Austin's questions, do you maintain that the records and documentation were sufficient at the time of the audit?
Yes, sir, we do.
Then why did you have to put on testimony and evidence before the hearing officer? Why didn't you just rely on the documentation as it existed at the time of the audit?
Well, we had the right to put on testimony. We thought the testimony would be helpful.
That in the question, but not whether he has the right to or not.
We thought it would be helpful to explain what a residential treatment center is, what we do every day, as well as the documentation.
Necessary help to do that if the documentation and records were sufficient at the time of the audit?
Well, this is a very complicated area of the law, and we thought it would be helpful to take advantage of our right to put on evidence and witnesses to describe what they do every day to these children, what a treatment session is.
Yeah. Well, wasn't the substance of that evidence to fill in the blanks that were not covered in the documentation? Wasn't that what it was all about? Here's what we did, basketball.
Was that what it was all about? It was to explain what the documentation meant, what was there, not necessarily to fill in gaps. We thought the documentation was sufficient. For example, you're talking about what are, there's a 9004, the error code, requires 21 non-billable sessions in which treatment interventions are provided.
And that includes playing basketball.
It includes
having lunch together. Is that right?
It is. It's not an exclusive list. It's not saying these could only be the non-billable sessions. It says recreation, social skills.
But to follow up on Judge Haley's question, and again, it's a very good question, is if I'm an auditor, again, I know nothing about this particular auditing, that's not my area of expertise, but if I'm an auditor and I look down on the piece of paper that says what service was performed, and I see played basketball, instinctively I'm going to say, I'm no doctor, I don't know how that's going to help their interpersonal development, social skills, and the like. So I'm going to look at it and say, play basketball, I'm not going to allow that. But Judge Haley's question is, instead of saying on the piece of paper, play basketball, why would there be a more definitive or a more developed statement as to what playing basketball was to accomplish for this particular individual? This individual has, I'm just making this up, individual has autism, and playing basketball allows this individual to become more comfortable in social environments. Our documentation has suggested that if we have an autistic individual, that putting him with people that he is comfortable with will help him in his social skills development. And so therefore, if this particular individual playing basketball is important, as opposed to the kid who has defined behavior, that might be not be necessarily a good social skill for him to have basketball to develop.
Right. Great question. So, but understand, in this, the treatment documentations, the auditor accepted 3 of the 5 sessions at issue.
But the fact of the matter is, in the documentation that was subject to the audit, it didn't say play basketball, did it?
It said gym time. It said watching American Idol under recreation, gym time, watching American Idol. These are in the joint appendix.
I thought you said you had to offer testimony to fill in the gaps as to what was actually done for this 21 hours.
The auditor didn't need any gaps filled for those sessions. The auditor accepted, and we make this very clear in our documents and our reply, the auditor accepted sessions entitled Recreation, and you're right, in that it would say Gym Time, American Idol, hiking, biking, and sessions that were identified as social skills. Without any need of supplemental testimony based on the documentation. But then there were sessions that the auditor didn't accept, that when they were entitled manners, hygiene, self-soothing, nurturing, even though they were documented exactly the same way. Even though, Your Honor, when it said basketball or gym time, that wasn't to teach foul shots. It was just an opportunity.
But I think that the position of the department would be that the reason why we do these audits is because there's a responsibility under the contract to provide 21 hours of non-billable services. Mm-hmm. And if you are, I'm not suggesting your client's doing this, but if you are using things like basketball and hygiene and all that to sort of fill in those gaps of the 21 non-billable hours that you have to put in, that sort of skews the invoice that is sent to the department
Well, the department accepted gym time as one of the appropriate sessions of treatment interventions. The department accepted another recreation time when it was entitled American Idol. In the second half of the audit, if you'll look in the joint appendices between 562 and 573, there is social activities that they accepted. And under that, it's written dinner. Now, eating together is one of the examples of non-billable treatment sessions that are in the manual. That was accepted, eating together. Dinner, where it was social skills activity, dinner. The auditor accept that. And that was, the hearing officer went through that with the auditor at the hearing. It was very clear. Now, of course, DMAS will say, well, eating is a non-mental health need. But that's not the point. It was, people get together around a table and there's social interaction and opportunity for kids that have some of these dysfunctional behaviors to interact and opportunities for the counselors to, provide these behavior modification techniques. These are the interventions that...
Let me ask you this. Your time is...
Yes, sir.
You have about a time. I'm going to ask you a quick question. What is our standard of review?
Their standard here is, because I think this is substantial evidence, is would a reasonable mind necessarily, looking at the record as a whole, necessarily come out with a different decision? And I think the answer there is yes, because even in the second portion of the audit, when the provider started tracking its sessions 7 days a week as opposed to five, which is not controverted, you just do the math. And you do two recreation sessions a day. You do one social skills session a day. With the agents, the auditor said, we accept it. And there are other sessions that go there.
It's the same standard of review that Judge Spencer had on the circuit court.
Yes, sir.
I'll give you a rebuttal time in a little bit. We've had a lot of questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Osha Kaduru, and I represent the Department of Medical Assistance Services, which I'll refer to as DMAS today. This appeal is about DMAS's ability to retract payment for failure to document 21 sessions.
Let me go to Mr. Shea's suggested argument here and see how you respond.
Sure.
Mr. Shea has suggested it, and he's suggested it very, very rather zealously, is that the documentation that has been provided in this case is not dissimilar from documentation that has been provided in other audits that has been acceptable. So why is DMAS allowed to change the rules now when something has been considered appropriate in the past and suddenly it is now not appropriate?
We believe that the prior audit is irrelevant to the appeal. The hearing officer in this case only has the authority to make a recommended decision on the agency action before him, applying the regulations and policies to the evidence before him. And with
so
respect
the
to the
hearing officer is not the fact finder, the agency director.
the hearing officer is the fact finder. However, the agency may reject the hearing officer's findings if they're not supported by the record. And in this particular case, with respect to
the agency director, just want to get this straight. The agency director's standard of review is a substantial evidence
yes.
as well, just like the circuit court, just like us.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. With respect to that prior audit, to answer your question, Judge Alston, we would argue that the course of performance, course of dealing principle of contract law actually probably has been displaced by the operation of the Administrative Process Act. And I say that because under the course of I say that because when you look at a case decision on appeal, that is subject to the APA. And under the APA, you're looking at the case decision before the hearing officer, and the trial court is also looking at the agency action. And so they're limited to looking at the agency action to determine whether there's substantial evidence in the record.
But looking at it pragmatically, and that's I'm a pragmatist, so I try to make things make sense. If I'm Alice Tyler Village for Child Health Group, and I have been providing services that I deem appropriate, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt that they deem these services that they're providing appropriate, and I've been documenting these services in a particular way, and in the past, this documentation has been sufficient. And in addition to that, not only has it been deemed sufficient, but I've been paid for it, and now someone comes in and says, well, what you did in the past was not appropriate. The fact that we paid you is not significant. And the fact that a hearing officer has said, well, you did what was expected, the director has said that this isn't inappropriate, so therefore, we want our money back.
Sure.
That present a pretty draconian circumstance for the provider?
I think it could put the provider in a difficult situation, but the agency is tasked with making sure that it complies with the provider agreement, which includes the manual and the regulations. In this particular case, with the current audit, it actually did comply with the manual regulations and the policies. With respect to the prior audit, I would submit that DMAS actually didn't follow its own provider agreement, because when it accepted that additional documentation, as this court is well aware of, DMAS has always argued that additional documentation can't supplement the documentation gaps that are there in the audit. That is something that the agency
DMAS
did.
So DMAS changed the rules would be a little unfair, but DMAS' decision to now implement existing rules is the question.
I would say that they made a mistake in not applying the rules in the first audit. However, with respect to the current audit, DMAS is consistently applying the provider agreement through its manual and regulations. And this court has made it very clear, and DMAS has consistently, since that prior audit, this court and DMAS has consistently said that you have to maintain proper documentation.
Just so I know, and again, I'm no expert on this, but I try to learn things that I'm not as good at. Is there any mechanism for DMAS after the audit is conducted to say to the provider, hey, look, in the past we've done things one way, but we're going to have and expect strict adherence and strict compliance with the letter of our regulations. So therefore, to be able to justify your position, you're going to need to provide us additional information to basically supplement the file. Thereby, and now you're on notice that prospectively, we're not going to let you supplement, but this one time we are. Is there any mechanism for that to happen?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that there is. I think the difference is that in the prior audit, which took place in 2006 and 2007, I think the landscape had changed a little bit. DMAS was looking at its provider agreements and looking at its manual, and the Psychiatric Solutions decision had come out, which says that contract principles apply, and it emphasized the need for maintaining proper documentation. So I think the agency was guided by the principles of this court's decision in determining how it was supposed to look at and review the documentation in the provider's files. So even though the prior audit took place, and I would submit that DMAS didn't comply with its provider agreement, that the agency was informed by this court's decision in Psychiatric Solutions and correctly applied all of the provider agreements and manual language that was always there.
I'm going back to the question I asked counsel. How much detail does the does DMAS require to be provided for an audit? And in this case, I'm trying to figure out why the center had to offer testimony and evidence before the hearing officer. To fill in the gaps, how would you characterize the difference between, how would you characterize how much of the gaps had to be filled in?
I would submit that there were a lot of gaps that the provider had to submit. And the way the formal hearing works is it's an opportunity. It's a de novo hearing, so it's an opportunity for the providers to come to that hearing to provide whatever evidence it might be, whether it's testimony, whether it's documentation. Now, the courts have said, though, I believe it first mentioned in First Stop, in that case, that additional documentation cannot be submitted. That's post-audit. However, that case also discussed the fact that providers are able to have this formal hearing because that's part of their due process, and that is allowed under the Administrative Process Act. What isn't allowed is the submission of that post-audit documentation and testimony to supplement whatever deficiencies the auditor has identified.
In other words, you can't correct the audit, but you can offer information and evidence.
You can provide all the testimony and evidence that you need, but if it's being used to supplement a deficiency in documentation, that probably is not allowed, and that's pursuant to First Stop.
But what other purpose would that be presented for?
For example, there could be an issue where the documentation perhaps might be somewhat open to interpretation as to what was in there, and so the testimony perhaps could clarify maybe perhaps some ambiguous language.
Isn't that exactly what they were trying to do, to say what they did with the 21-hour?
No, Your Honor, I don't think there was any ambiguity in the documentation. The documentation just wasn't there. And DMAS felt that with respect to the 21 interventions that there wasn't adequate documentation of how the interventions related to the recipient-specific goals specifically. And then with the second error code, the plan for the next session, that there is no dispute that that was not included in the progress.
Would an example, again, correct me if I'm wrong, would an example be that if some of the documentation regarding a particular child said PTSD, and no one knew what we all know what it is, but no one knew what PTSD is, someone could come in and testify that PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. Would that be the type of information?
Perhaps, yes. But that post-audit documentation and testimony can't fill in what's not already there.
Okay.
And that's the distinction.
Is that what happened to you?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe for both of the error codes, for error code 9004, for the lack of documentation of the 21 interventions, there wasn't enough documentation to show where those particular activities, especially as it related to the self-soothing, nurturing, manners, and hygiene, those particular types of activities related to the recipient-specific goals. And that is a requirement in the manual that says that the progress notes must contain this particular information.
So your position in a nutshell is that DMAS is not changing the rules vis-a-vis Alice C. Tyler, but rather is following court precedent with regard to what it must do to be in compliance with the holdings in Psychiatric Solutions and First Stop.
That is true, and also in the Culpepper case. So we believe that First Stop and Culpepper also apply.
Let me ask you on that, and I understand that was my question too that Judge Alston just asked. But what do you do then to let your providers know that you expect something different? Yes, you're basing it on decisions of this court and court precedent that you feel you need to follow. But what do you do to allow them to have some indication of that? Yes, they're supposed to know what the law is, but do you do something to say, okay, now we accepted, if I'm right on this, Jim Tom before, but we're not going to accept that next time. We need further explanation.
Two things. DMAS did issue, when the First Stop decision came out, they issued what's called a provider memo to all of the providers. Anyone who's a Medicaid provider gets this memo, and DMAS explained the First Stop decision and how it would impact audits. They
is
do that.
Is that in the record?
No, Your Honor, that was not something that was discussed during the administrative appeal or during the trial court. However, but to answer your question, that is one mechanism. Secondly, DMAS makes very clear in its through its provider agreement and through its manual that if you do not, that you are supposed to comply with DMAS regulations, policies, and state and federal laws with respect to your documentation. Moreover, the manual makes very clear that if you don't maintain adequate documentation to support your claims, DMAS will retract payment. So it is found throughout the manual, and regardless of the services that you provide, whether you're a residential treatment center like Alice C. Tyler or if you're a dental provider, all of the manuals include some variation of that language, in addition to every single provider agreement that's signed by any Medicaid provider also has that.
And that portion that you just described would be in the record.
Yes, the Medicaid provider agreement's in the record, and then the language in the manual that says that if you fail to maintain adequate documentation to support your claims, your payment will be retracted. That's also in the record.
Was with the present documentation, the original documentation in this case, would that have been acceptable in a prior order?
I don't believe it would have been, Your Honor, at least
but,
with respect
but it was
to...
accepted.
It was accepted, yes, Your Honor. I don't believe it would have been accepted if it were looked at today because that documentation, and it's in the record, was based on post-audit documentation.
Does the provider have any right or any reasonable belief that, gee, this is how I did it before and I'm doing it again that same way? And y'all said it was okay this way, but how come it's not okay this way?
I think the providers are absolutely required to know what's in their provider agreement that they signed. They are absolutely required to know what's in the manual that says this is the information that's required to submit your claims, and if you don't submit the claims, then you're almost out of luck.
So the answer to Judge Haley's question is in the past it would have been accepted, but it would have also been non-compliant.
I will say that in the past it was accepted with respect to that particular audit. I can't speak to all of the audits that were conducted, but in that particular audit it was. And it was in contravention of what the provider agreement and the manual stated.
I guess, again, I'm trying to find out, other than they need to be aware of what state law is and follow it, what tells them that, okay, it was acceptable in the last audit, that wasn't, we didn't follow our own procedures, or we now have a court decision that says otherwise. So what specifically tells them that you've got to do more in the next? What you're documenting now, if you want to pass it to the next audit?
Well, when the auditor actually does the audit and they give them a list of what the error codes are and what documentation deficiencies, they cite to, with respect to every single error code, why they're retracting.
That's after the fact, right? That's telling what you didn't do, and now we're going to disallow. What tells
sure.
them ahead of time?
Ahead of time, again, as I've stated, the provider agreement informs them of what they're required to be following.
The provider agreement still the same?
It is the same, and then the manual is still the same. I would submit, though, that DMAS made that mistake in the prior audit. So if the provider is relying on a prior audit, I believe it was just Judge Alston who had mentioned, are you arguing detrimental reliance, essentially? Well, to the extent they're arguing detrimental reliance, that's an equitable argument that's not allowed under the APA. Can't use it against the Commonwealth to stop the government from retracting payment.
Any evidence in the record that the provider got this memo after the first time?
I don't believe so, and I don't believe that was something that was even contemplated by the provider.
So there's no testimony in the record that even such a memo was sent to all providers?
That memo is actually on the DMAS website, and that should be sent to all of the providers. So other than...
But the question is, as far as the record in this matter, there's no information to suggest that either it was sent, not saying it wasn't, mm-hmm. that either it was sent or was received.
It was not raised by the provider, and so it was not in the record.
Yes, ma'am.
Let you go over a little bit because we had so many questions. Do you want to briefly wrap up?
Yes, Your Honor. For all of the reasons that I've stated for all, and also the briefs that were filed, we respectfully request that this court uphold the trial court's decision upholding the DMAS final agency decision. Thank you.
Mr. Shea, you have your rebuttal time. I'll give you a little extra time to
A couple just quick points. First of all, that first stop memo wouldn't have helped us, right? Even if the provider had gotten it, it is well after the time of the documents here. First stop memo, I don't know what the date is, but it had to come almost by definition. The case wasn't decided until 2014, after the period of time that was at issue.
Yeah, 2014 is after 2007,
thank
2007,
you.
So
yes.
Therefore
yeah.
You could have had it before.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good point.
And a little late, even if you want to try to supplement the documentation,
exactly.
You remember what was happening.
Exactly. And you know, as to these other cases with Culpepper, Ablix, and Morrison, you know, DMAS keeps referring back to, well, it's in the provider, it's in the provider, and then there is a manual. But in those cases, there were specific citations in the manual. For example, I believe in Ablix and in Morrison, there was a specific DMAS form, DMAS 90, that they said, you have to fill this out, and if you don't do it separately, we're retracting. In Culpepper, it said, that's a hospital case, you must have a separate certification by a doctor to support medical necessity, and if you don't, we retract. That's not what we have here. We have.
And that was a change, if I remember, in Culpepper, that you didn't used to have a doctor.
Right. And in those cases, the providers admitted, listen, we messed up. We didn't have it. But they argued material breach. So and that's where this row of cases say, well, no, you know what? You kind of bargained that away. If you don't comply, we retract. But in this case, there was no specific. He said, you have to have a progress note, but it doesn't have to be in a certain form. And based on the earlier audit, we were told, you guys did it right. Because 9008 was a specific error code. It wasn't just, oh, you didn't get it. It was a specific error code initially, as counsel said. They sent out the initial determination, you owe us $802,000 because of this error code. We sent in records, as we're allowed to do. They look at it and say, you're good. No retraction. You owe us no money. So that's what's so frustrating here. And in addition, that the auditor accepted our documentation for the 21 sessions for recreation, for social skills. And we documented those services the exact same way as we documented all the other services, yet they rejected them because it didn't have some word, I guess. I don't know. There was no basis for it.
So. You are dealing with the government.
They're our friends. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. We request respectfully that you reject DMAS's final determination.
Thank you. I appreciate your argument. We will greet counsel and then the court.